Yeah, good afternoon. It's time to go on in our journey through English prose. We have arrived in the 18th century, and we now come upon a passage, not yet, this is your life before, valuing himself not a little. We can go by paragraphs, one after the other. And the language always comes a bit nearer to the way we use it. Good then.
Great and done. Valuing himself not a little upon his elegance, being indeed a proper man of his person, this talkative now applied himself to his dress with animadversions of some heat upon the sudden whimsy of the atmospherics, while the company lavished their encomiums upon the project he had advanced. The young gentleman, his friend, overjoyed as he was at a passage that had befallen him, could not forbear to tell it his nearest neighbour. Mr. Mulligan, now perceiving the table, asked for whom were those loaves and fishes, and seeing the stranger, he made him a civil bow and said, "Pray, sir, was you in need of any professional assistance we could give?" Who, upon his offer, thanked him very heartily, though preserving his proper distance, and replied that he was come there about a lady, now an inmate of Horn's house, that was in an interesting condition, poor lady, from woman's woe. And here he fetched a deep sigh, to know if her happiness had yet taken place. Mr. Dixon, to turn the table, took on to ask Mr. Mulligan himself whether his incipient ventripotence, upon which he rallied him, betokened an overplastic gestation in the prostatic utricle or male womb, or was due, as with the noted physician, Mr. Austin Meldon, to a wolf in the stomach. For answer, Mr. Mulligan, in a gale of laughter at his smalls, smote himself bravely below the diaphragm, exclaiming, with an admirable droll mimic of Mother Brogan, the most excellent creature of her sex, though 'tis pity she's a trollop, "There's a belly that never bore a bastard." This was so happy a conceit that it renewed the storms of mirth and threw the whole room into the most violent agitations of delight. The spry rattle had run on in the same vein of mimicry, but for some larum in the antechamber.
Valuing himself not a little upon his elegance, indeed the problem is his person, this talkative, that's here a noun, obviously Mulligan, now applied himself to his dress with animadversions of some heat upon the sudden whimsy of the atmospheric, the chances of the weather, while the company lavished their encomium praise upon the project he had advanced, a kind of fertilizing form. The young gentleman, his friend, overjoyed as he was at the patch that befallen him, that's probably Bannon who has come to town, could not forbear to tell his nearest neighbour. Mr. Mulligan, now perceiving the table, asked for whom were those loaves and fishes. You know, they have beer on the table, horse beer, and sardines, and of course he calls it loaves and fishes from the Bible, where I think there was a whole wedding, and there were five fish and two loaves of bread, or the other way around, and it was enough for the whole company. So that's been loaves and fishes. And see, the stranger, that is Bloom, made him a civil bow and said, "Pray, sir, was you in need of any professional assistance we could give?" As though Bloom in a maternity hospital wanted some assistance. That's Mulligan with his usual jokes. Who, upon his offer, thanked him very heartily, though preserving his proper distance, and replied, that's Bloom, with a proper distance, that it was come there about a lady, now an inmate of Horn's house, that was in an interesting condition. He had come for Mrs. Purefoy, and as you perhaps know, the word for pregnant has often been circumscribed. She's in an interesting condition. I think we have to say it in German. Poor lady. From woman's woe, And here he fetched a deep sigh to know if her happiness had yet taken place. So Bloom is the one with real concern. Mr. Dixon, the doctor, to turn the table, took on to ask Mr. Mulligan himself whether his incipient ventripotence, remember I talked about the fertilizing form, and that would be the potency of his belly, upon which he rallied him, betokened, and now he gets into the medical language, overblastic gestation in the prostatic utricle or male womb. There must be something like a male womb, and the chapter is full of medical obstetric echoes with a noted physician, Mr. Austin Meldon, to a wolf in the stomach. Somebody who eats very much, as we is said to have a wolf in the stomach. For answer, Mr. Mulligan, in a gale of laughter at his fall, smote himself bravely below the diaphragm, exclaiming with an admirable draw mimic of Mother Grogan. Remember, he had imitated Mother Grogan, an Irish woman. When I make tea, I make tea. And now he comes back to the same routine. The most excellent creature of her sex, totis pili, tis pity, she's a trollop. That refers to, I think, Elizabethan play, tis pity, she's a whore. Trollop is there's a belly that never bore a bastard. Buck Mulligan. This was so happy a conceit. And of course, this chapter features words like conceit, which is a notion, but it also has to do with conception. That it renewed the storm of mirth and threw the whole room into most violent agitation of delight. The spry red had run on. That is, the lively events had gone on, it is in the sense of they would have gone on, which at one time that German-looking construction was customary, had run on in the same vein of mimicry, but for some alarum noise in the antechamber. So there's an interruption. Good.
Here the listener, who was none other than the Scotch student, a little fume of a fellow, blonde as tow, congratulated in the liveliest fashion with the young gentleman, and interrupting the narrative at a salient point, having desired his vis-a-vis with a polite beck to have the obligingness to pass him a flagon of cordial waters, at the same time, by a questioning poise of the head, a whole century of polite breeding had not achieved so nice a gesture, to which was united an equivalent but contrary balance of the head, asked the narrator as plainly as was ever done in words if he might treat him with a cup of it. Mais bien, sir, noble stranger, said he cheerily, a mille compliments, that you may, and very opportunely. There wanted nothing but this cup to crown my felicity, but gracious heaven, was I left with but a crust in my wallet and a cupful of water from the well, my God, I would accept of them and find it in my heart to kneel down upon the ground and give thanks to the powers above for the happiness vouchsafed me by the giver of good things. With these words, he approached the goblet to his lips, took a complacent draught of the cordial, slicked his hair, and opening his bosom, out popped a locket that hung from a silk ribbon, that very picture which he had cherished ever since her hand had groped therein. Gazing upon those features with a world of tenderness, ah, monsieur, he said, had you but beheld her as I did, with those eyes at that affecting instant, with her dainty tucker and her new coquette cap, a gift for her feast day, as she told me, in such an artless disorder, of so melting a tenderness, upon my conscience, even you, monsieur, had been impelled by generous nature to deliver yourself wholly into the hands of such an enemy, or to quit the field forever. I declare I was never so touched in all my life. God, I thank thee as the author of my days. Thrice happy will he be, whom so amiable a creature will bless with her favours. A sigh of affection gave eloquence to these words, and having replaced the locket in his bosom, he wiped his eye and sighed again. Beneficent disseminator of blessings to all thy creatures, How great and universal must be that sweetest of thy tyrannies, which can hold in thrall the free and the bond, the simple swain and the polished coxcomb, the lover in the heyday of reckless passion and the husband of maturer years. But indeed, sir, I wander from the point. How mingled and imperfect are all our sublunary joys. Maledicity, would to God that foresight had remembered me to take my cloak along. I could weep to think of it. Then, though it had poured 7 showers, we were neither of us a penny the worse. But beshrew me, he cried, clapping hand to his forehead, tomorrow'll be a new day, and 1,000 thunders. I know of a marchand de capote, Monsieur Poins, from whom I can have for a livre as snug a cloak of the French fashion as ever kept a lady from wetting. Tut, tut, cries Le Fecondateur, tripping in. My friend Monsieur Moore, that most accomplished traveller, I have just cracked a half bottle of Aigris in a circle of the best wits of the town, is my authority that in Cape Horn, Ventre Biche, they have a rain that will wet through any, even the stoutest cloak. A drenching of that violence, he tells me, sans blague, has sent more than one luckless fellow in good earnest post-haste to another world. Who, a livre, cries Monsieur Lynch. The clumsy things are dear at a sou. One umbrella, were it no bigger than a fairy mushroom, is worth 10 such stopgaps. No woman of any wit would wear one. My dear Kitty told me today that she would dance in a deluge before ever she would starve in such an ark of salvation, for, as she reminded me, blushing piquantly and whispering in my ear that there was none to snap her words but giddy butterflies, Dame Nature, by the divine blessing, has implanted it in her heart, and it has become a household word that il y a deux choses, for which the innocence of our original garb, in other circumstances, a breach of the proprieties, is the fittest, nay, the only garment. The first, said she, and here my pretty philosopher, as I handed her to her tilbury, to fix my attention, gently tipped with her tongue the outer chamber of my ear. The first is a bath. But at this point, a bell tinkling in the hall cut short a discourse which promised so bravely for the enrichment of our store of knowledge.
Yeah, that was a long one. And in the nature of Tristram Shandy, Stern. Stern, the writer of Tristram Shandy and The Sentimental Journey. And Stern is the one who already played with the new medium, the novel, and it's a kind of forerunner to Ulysses. And Joyce considered him Irish. And there's a story I've heard at the Zurich post office where Joyce saw a postal clerk reading an English novel and asked, and it was Dickens, and Joyce said, you mustn't read Dickens, you must read Stern. He was Irish, so he had a great, there's a lot of helpful. Here, the listener, who was none other than the Scotch student, there's a Scotchman too, a little fume of a fellow, Blunderstown, congratulated in the liveliest fashion with a young gentleman and, interrupting the narrative at a salient point, that is what Stern does, Lawrence Stern does very often, that in Tristram Shandy, that something is disrupted or interrupted, not in the normal order. Having desired his vis-a-vis with a polite beck to have the obligatoriness to pass him a flagon of cordial waters, which of course here is the beer. At the same time, by a questioning pose of the head, a whole century of polite breeding had not achieved so nice a gesture, to which was united an equivalent but contrary balance of the head, asked the narrator, as plainly as was ever done, in words, if he might treat him with a cup of it. Mais bien sûr, noble stranger, he said cheerily. And Lawrence also sometimes gets into French and other languages, he said, cheerily, et mille compliments, that you may very opportunely, this is the politeness of the 18th century also, there wanted nothing but this cup to crown my felicity. But, gracious heaven, was I left with, if I were left, was I left with but a crust in my wallet and a cupful of water from the well? My God, I would accept of them and find it in my heart to kneel down upon the ground and give thanks to the powers above for the happiness which saved me by the giver of good things. With these words, he approached the goblet to his lips, took a complacent draught of the cordial, slicked his hair, and opening his bosom, out popped a locket that hung from a silk ribbon, that very picture which he had cherished ever since he had her, he had wrote therein. Now he has a locket, and it's obviously with a small photograph, the head of the girl that you got to know, which we know is Millie Bloom in Mullingar. But Bloom, of course, doesn't recognize, it doesn't know Bannon at all. Gazing upon these features with a world of tenderness, ah, monsieur, he said, had you but beheld her as I did with these eyes, at that affecting instant which her dainty tucker and their new coquette cap, tucker is something to wear, and a new coquette cap, and we know that Bloom sent Millie, whose birthday was yesterday, a cap, a tam o' shanter, as a birthday present, so we can know who is talked about. Gift for a feast day, as she told me, feast day is a birthday. In such an artless disorder, artless disorder is, of course, a contradiction. It means a disorder that has been carefully constructed. Of so melting a tenderness, upon my conscience, even you, monsieur, highly impelled by generous nature, deliver yourself wholly into the hands of such an enemy, or to quit the field forever. You see also here, we don't know exactly what is spoken in which words, because all is transposed into the language of the author. Right. I declare, I was never so touched in all my life. God, I thank thee as the author of my days. Thrice happy will he be whom so amiable a creature will bless with her favours. The sigh of affection gave eloquence to these words, and having placed the locket in his bosom, he wiped his eye and sighed again. Beneficent disseminator of blessings to all thy creatures, that is one way of the God, disseminator of blessings, that's what God can do. But of course, disseminator also fits into the chapter of birth and fertility to creatures. How great and universal must be that sweetest of thy tyrannies. Father Conmedy, the Jesuit priest, at the beginning of the 10th chapter, walking in the fields, had thought of the sexual desire, that tyranny, from the point of view of a clergyman, the suit of thy tyrannies, which can hold in thrall the free and the bond, the simple swain and the polished coxcomb, that's from your dandy or something. A lover in the heyday of reckless passion and the husband of maturer years. But indeed, sir, I wander from the point, something that Lawrence and, of course, Joyce do very often. How mingled and imperfect are all our sublunary joys. Maledicity, Would to God that foresight had remembered me to take my cloak along. And here they talk indirectly about contraception and the means of it. And it seems he also came to Dublin to get some sort of the equivalent of what are condoms now. I don't quite know how exactly they were, often out of gut or something like that. So there's the cloak along, so that's the motive of infertility. I could weep to think of it then, though it had poured 7 showers, we were neither of a penny the worse, a kind of protection. But beshrew me, he cried, clapping hand to his forehead, tomorrow will be a new day, and 1,000 thunders. I know of that Marchand de Chabot, Monsieur Points, there must have been a shop of that sort, from whom I can have for a livre, that's the French coin, of course, pound, a snug cloche of the French fashion as ever kept a lady from wetting. Condoms, and as I say, I don't quite know what they were made of at that time. They're also called French letters, because all the the sexual activities are projected to the neighbors, the French do it. Tata, cried le fécondateur, Mulligan, tripping in, my friend Monsieur Moore. Monsieur Moore is George Moore. He's sometimes mentioned, an important Irish writer who had spent a long time in France and now came back to the Irish movement and lived in Dublin. And he had given a party from where Mulligan comes. My friend Monsieur Moore, that most accomplished traveller, I have just cracked a half bottle elegantly in a circle of the best wits of the town. So there has been a party to which we know Mulligan was invited, as he would be, as an entertainer, but Stephen was explicitly not invited. In the circle of the best wits of the town is my oily that in Cape Horn, Ventre Biche, French, they have a rain that will wet through any, even the stoutest cloak. Obviously, Cape Horn has to do with horny and sexual excitement. And a cape is probably also a kind of a protection or umbrella or prevention. So it's an indirect way to talk about contraception, which, of course, was absolutely and strongly forbidden in Ireland, both by the English law and the Catholic teachings. But in the stoutest cloak, at wrenching of that violence, he tells us, Chauvelac has sent more than one luckless fellow in good earnest, post haste, to another world. I don't quite follow here, I must say. A lever, cries Monsieur Lynch. The clumsy things are dear at the sou. So obviously the price is a livre was a French franc. Sou is the lowest coin. So obviously they would be overpriced because forbidden. One umbrella, bigger than a fairy mushroom, is worth 10 such stopgaps. Maybe that was a kind of another way of contraception. No woman of any wit would wear one. My dear Kitty told me today, Lynch has been out with Kitty, that she would dance in a deluge before she would ever starve in such an ark of salvation. For, as she reminded me, flushing piquantly and whispering in my ear, though there was none to snap her words but give butterflies, Dame Nature, by the divine blessing, has implanted it in our hearts, and it has become a household word that, then in the French, il y a deux choses, for which the innocent of our original garb, that is clothes that we wear. In other circumstances, a breach of the proprieties. You can't go around naked, that's a breach of the proprieties. Is the fittest, nay, the only garment, the first, said she. And here my petty philosopher, as I handed to Tilbury to fix my attention, gently tipped her tongue the outer chamber of my ear. Now, Lynch and Kitty, they are the couple that came out of the bushes when Father Conmee walked by, reading his breviary in the 10th chapter. I'm here also a kind of substitute memory, huh, for the kind of things we have forgotten. So, there are two occasions where you can go without clothes. The first is a bath, and you can imagine what the second would be. But at this point, a bell tinkling in the hall cut short the discourse which promised so bravely for the enrichment of us all of knowledge. And readers of The Sentimental Journey will know that it climaxes in a scene where I think the narrator, a man, is in the same room with a lady in different beds, and he just reaches over and then the book closes. So the curtain comes down before the climax. So that's a kind of Lawrence trick or sort. Good.
Amid the general vacant hilarity of the assembly, a bell rang, and while all were conjecturing what might be the cause, Miss Callan entered, and having spoken a few words in a low tone to young Mr. Dixon, retired with a profound bow to the company. The presence, even for a moment, among a party of debauchees, of a woman endued with every quality of modesty, and not less severe than beautiful, refrained the humorous sallies even of the most licentious. But her departure was the signal for an outbreak of ribaldry. "Strike me silly," said Costello, a low fellow who was fuddled. "A monstrous fine bit of cow flesh. I'll be sworn she has rendezvoused you. What, you dog? Have you away with them? Gad's bud." "Immensely so," said Mr. Lynch. "The bedside manner it is that they use in the matter hospice. Dammy, does not Dr. O'Gargle chuck the nuns there under the chin? As I look to be saved, I had it from my Kitty, who hath been ward maid there any time these 7 months. Lawks a mercy, doctor," cried the young blood in the primrose vest, feigning a womanish simper and a modest squirming of his body. "How do you tease a body? Drat the man, bless me, I'm all of a wibbly-wobbly. Why, you're as bad as dear little Father Cantacuzzo that you are." "May this pot of four half choke me," cried Costello, "if she ain't in the family way. I knows a lady what's got a white swelling, quick as I claps eyes on her." The young surgeon, however, rose and begged the company to excuse his retreat, as the nurse had just then informed him that he was needed in the ward. Merciful Providence had been pleased to put a period to the sufferings of the lady who was enceinte, which she had borne with a laudable fortitude, and she had given birth to a bouncing boy. "I want patience," said he, "with those who, without wit to enliven or learning to instruct, revile an ennobling profession, which, saving the reverence due to the deity, is the greatest power for happiness upon the earth. I am positive when I say that if need were, I could produce a cloud of witnesses to the excellence of her noble exercitations, which, so far from being a byword, should be a glorious incentive in the human breast. I cannot away with them. What? Malign such a one, the amiable Miss Callan, who is the luster of her own sex and the astonishment of ours, and at an instant the most momentous that can befall a puny child of clay. Perish the thought. I shudder to think of the future of a race where the seeds of such malice have been sown, and where no right reverence is rendered to mother and maid in House of Horn." Having delivered himself of this rebuke, he saluted those present on the by and repaired to the door. A murmur of approval arose from all, and some were for ejecting the low soaker without more ado, a design which would have been effected, nor would he have received more than his bare deserts, had he not abridged his transgression by affirming, with a horrid imprecation, for he swore a round hand, that he was as good a son of the true fold as ever drew breath. "Stop my vitals," said he. "Them was always the sentiments of honest Frank Costello, which I was bred up most particular to honour their father and their mother. that had the best hand to a roly-poly or a hasty pudding as you ever see, what I always looks back on with a loving heart.
And this is, the next is now in the reign of Oliver Goldsmith, who he wrote The Vicar of Wakefield and some plays, Irish too. And we have seen his statue outside of Trinity earlier on. Amid the general vacant hilarity of the assembly, a bell rang. And while all were conjecturing what might be the cause, Miss Callan entered. Miss Callan is the younger nurse, the more attractive one that we see. And having spoken a few words in a low tone to young Mr. Dixon, retired with a profound bow to the company. The presence, even for a moment, among a party of debauchees, of a woman endued with every quality of modesty and not less severe than beautiful, refrained the humorous chalice even of the most licentious. But her departure was the signal for an outbreak of rivalry. "Strike me silly," said Costello, a low fellow who was fuddled drunk. "A monstrous fine bit of whole cow flesh." It's quite interesting in the book here how often cows and heifers were compared with women in a positive sense. Seems to have been a sign of the times. "I'll be sworn she has rendezvoused you. What, you dog? Have you a way with them? God's parrot." "Immensely so," the Mr. Lynch. "The bedside manner, you know, that doctors must have a bedside manner." But of course, bedside manner could also suggest other things. "It is that they use in the martyr hospital, the bedside manner they use in the martyr hospice. Demi, does not Dr. O'Gargle, that's an imaginary doctor, chuck the nuns there under the chin?" So all kinds of goings on in hospitals. "As I looked to be saved, I had it from my Kitty," that is Lynch, who has been out in the bushes with Kitty, "who has been ward-maid there any time these 7 months. It's strange in Ulysses, there's never really any clear suggestion of abuse of women, which of course would happen in hospitals and everywhere, but here it's slightly alluded to, the 7 months. "Lawks a mercy, doctor," cried the young bird in the primrose vest, that's Buck Mulligan, feigning a womanish simper, he often plays womanly parts, and the modest squirmings of his body, "how do you tease a body?" "Drat them, bless me. I'm all of a wibbly wobbly." She's often acting like a woman. "Why, you're as bad as dear brother Father Catechism." That's, of course, a made up name. Father, it's based on catechism. But of course, also can't he kiss them? Again, there's you might say, a great deal of clerical, ecclesiastical license. "That you are. May this pot of four half choke me," cried Costello, "if she ain't in the family way." That is another way of saying pregnant. I think the word pregnant was usually avoided and circumscribed. And the same thing is true in German too, or was true. "I know a lady what's got a white swelling. Quick as I claps eyes on her." So it's a kind of boast. They get pregnant and I just look at them. The young surgeon, however, rose and begged the company to excuse his retreat, as the nurse had just been informed him that he was needed in the ward. It's surprisingly a lot of words, because the doctor, when they tell him a birth is one, it would be expected to run immediately rather than talk a long time. But here he focuses always on talk, while at the same time we don't know exactly what they're saying, which words they use, because the words are 18th century. Merciful Providence had been pleased to put the period to the sufferings of the lady. Period is a good word. To put the period of a lady who was enceinte, which she had borne with a laudable fortitude, and she had given birth to a bouncing boy. So, in this chapter, a boy is born. But you realize that it takes place offstage. We're basically kept with people who just talk, while what may well be the most important thing, a young child is born, but somehow upstairs, not where we are. "I want patience," said he, "with those who, without wit, to enliven or learning or to instruct, revile an ennobling profession, the nurses, with saving the reverence due to the deity, is the greatest power for happiness upon the earth. I am positive when I say that if need were, I could produce a cloud of witnesses," that's a phrase, a group of witnesses, "to the excellence of a noble exercitations, which, so far from being a byword, should be a glorious incentive in that human breast." You see that with the 18th century parodies, the sentences always have a kind of balance, which was typical at the time. "I cannot away with them. What maligns such a one, the amiable Miss Callan, who is the lust of her own sex and the astonishment of ours, and at an instant the most momentous that can befall a puny child of clay. Perish the thought. I shudder to think of the future of a race where the seeds of such malice have been sown, and where no right reverend is rendered to mother and maid in her house of horn." Having delivered himself of his rebuke, and of course the word "delivered himself" is again appropriate for a maternity hospital, he saluted those present on the by and repaired to the door. A murmur of approval arose from all, and some were for ejecting the low soaker without more ado, that is Costello, who made rival jokes, a design which had been effected, nor would he have received more than his fair deserts had he not abridged his transgression by a firm with a horrid imprecation, for he swore around hand, that he was as good a son of the true foal as ever drew breath. "Stop my vitals," said he. Then was always the sentiment of honest Frank Costello, "which was bred up most particularly to honour thy father and thy mother, that had the best hand to a roly-poly or hasty pudding, that's a housewife, as you ever see, what I always looks back on with a loving heart." And here it's almost going to back what I looks back on. I don't quite know which type of Irish says "I looks back on," but it is, it can be heard. So we come for a brief moment close to the actual speech. So the next is in the name of Edmund Burke, a great historical figure and also a great speaker and rhetorician. Irish.
To revert to Mr. Bloom, who after his first entry had been conscious of some impudent mocks, which he, however, had borne with being the fruits of that age, upon which it is commonly charged that it knows not pity. The young sparks, it is true, were as full of extravagancies as overgrown children, The words of their tumultuary discussions were difficultly understood, and not often nice. Their testiness and outrageous mot were such that his intellects resiled from. Nor were they scrupulously sensible of the proprieties, though their fund of strong animal spirits spoke in their behalf. But the word of Mr. Costello was an unwelcome language for him, for he nauseated the wretch that seemed to him a crop-eared creature of a misshapen gibbosity, born out of wedlock, and thrust like a crookback, teethed and feet first into the world, which the dint of the surgeon's pies in his skull lent indeed a colour to, so as to put him in thought of that missing link of creation's chain desiderated by the late ingenious Mr. Darwin. It was now for more than the middle span of our allotted years that he had passed through the thousand vicissitudes of existence, and being of a wary ascendancy, and self a man of rare forecast, he had enjoined his heart to repress all motions of a rising choler, and by intercepting them with the readiest precaution, foster within his breast that plenitude of sufferance which base minds jeer at, rash judges scorn, and all find tolerable and but tolerable. To those who create themselves wits at the cost of feminine delicacy, a habit of mind which he never did hold with, to them he would concede neither to bear the name nor to herit the tradition of a proper breeding, while for such that, having lost all forbearance, can lose no more, there remained the sharp antidote of experience to cause their insolency to beat a precipitate and inglorious retreat. Not but what he could feel with mettlesome youth, which, caring naught for the mows of dotards or the gruntlings of the severe, is ever, as the chaste fancy of the holy writer express it, for eating of the tree forbid it, yet not so far forth as to pretermit humanity upon any condition soever towards a gentlewoman when she was about her lawful occasions. To conclude, while from the sister's words he had reckoned upon a speedy delivery, he was, however, it must be owned, not a little alleviated by the intelligence that the issue so auspicated after an ordeal of such duress now testified once more to the mercy as well as to the bounty of the Supreme Being.
Okay. To revert to Mr. Bloom, who, after his first entry, had been conscious of some impudent mocks, which he, however, had borne with being the fruits of that age upon which his comely child that he knows not pity. Now, Bloom, as you see, has refrained from all jokes because he's really concerned and has empathy for a woman, especially with a difficult birth. So, but he hasn't said anything. Which is commonly charged, it knows not pity. These were mainly medical, young medical students. The young sparks, it is true, were as full of extravagances as overgrown children. The words of their tumultuary discussions were difficultly understood, and that's true. Often we don't easily follow what they're saying. And not often nice. Their testiness and outrageous moo were such that his intellect resiled from. So he doesn't go along, he finds it inappropriate, that kind of thing. Nor were they scrupulously sensible of the proprietors, though their fund of strong animal spirits spoke in their behalf. What do you think? They're still young, of course. But the word of Mr. Costello was an unwelcome language for him, for he nauseated the wretch. We can understand nauseated the wretch. We wouldn't say it like that. That seemed to him a crop-eared creature of a misshapen gibbosity, a humpback, born out of wedlock, thrust like a crook by teeth and feet first into the world. And here we can hear the words of Richard II, who in a very famous opening monologue says that he was misshapen and things like that and didn't have a gentle way. So these are the famous the kind of evil person, Richard, almost verbatim. Which, by dint of the surgeon's pliers, that's the pliers for the birth, Gebutz Tongen, pliers in his skull, lent indeed a colour to. So, as to put him in thought of the missing link of creation, chained as iterated by the late ingenious Mr. Darwin. And here now there's something, of course, is chronic, is extra, is not out of time, because Darwin comes later than the 18th century. So this is a kind of anticipation. And of course, Darwin with his evolution talked about missing links. But that's anachronistic. It was now for more than the middle span of our allotted years. We know Bloom is 38. And as you know, in the Bible, the age is 30 or 37. Mm-hmm. So Bloom, the half of life as well is gone, that he had passed through the thousand vicissitudes of existence, and being of a wary ascendancy, and self a man of rare forecast, prudent, looking ahead, he had enjoined his heart to repress all motions of arising choler, of anger. So he has been used to suppress his man. That is also a trait that Odysseus has. By intercepting them with the readiest precaution, foster within his breast that plenitude of sufferance which base mind Gerard Rush judges scorn. So he's tolerating all these jokes, and all find tolerable and but tolerable. Do those who create themselves wits at the cost of feminine delicacy, a habit of mind which he never did hold with, and we've seen that all through the book, he has always been thinking of with a sympathy of women bearing children or people in bad conditions. To them, he would concede neither to bear the name nor heritage tradition of proper breeding. Why, for such that, having lost all forbearance, can lose no more, there remained the sharp antidote of experience to cause the insolency, to beat the precipitant enclosure. He means here, until they have bad experience themselves, they don't learn what it is to sympathize. Not but what he could feel with a mettlesome youth, an energetic youth, which, caring not for the mows of dotards and gruntlings, mow, I think, is a Shakespearean word for a grimace, an expression of the face, of dotards and the gruntlings of the severe, is ever, as the chaste fancy of the holy writer expresses it, for eating of the tree forbid, that is eating of the forbidden tree, forbidden fruit, the first sin. It yet not so far forth as to pretermit humanity upon any condition soever towards a gentleman, woman, when she was about her lawful occasions. To conclude, while from the sister's words he already reckoned upon a speedy delivery, he was, however, it must be owned, not a little alleviated, as he would be. He is, of course, relieved, because he came to ask of the birth, and now she has given birth and is better off. By the intelligent that you issue, so to birth, so auspicated, after an ordeal of such duress, it took a long time, now testify once more to the mercy as well as to the bounty of the Supreme Being. Now, in my view here, the the author that is imitated would say that, because Brew himself is not the believer and doesn't probably want to give thanks to God, so that his own attitude is probably overridden by the style of the author. I for one can't imagine Bloom thinking in those religious terms. The next one is now in the style of Sheridan, who was also an Irish playwright.
Accordingly, he broke his mind to his neighbour, saying that to express his notion of the thing, his opinion, who ought not perchance to express one, was that one must have a cold constitution and a frigid genius not to be rejoiced by this freshest news of the fruition of her confinement, since she had been in such pain through no fault of hers. The dressy young blade said it was her husband that put her in that expectation, or at least it ought to be, unless she were another Ephesian matron. I must acquaint you, said Mr. Crothers, clapping on the table so as to evoke a resonant comment of emphasis. Old Glory Alleluiarum was round again today, an elderly man with Dundreary's, preferring through his nose a request to have word of Wilhelmina, my life, as he calls her. I bade him hold himself in readiness, for that the event would burst anon. Slife, I'll be round with you. I cannot but extol the virile potency of the old bucko that could still knock another child out of her. All fell to praising of it, each after his own fashion. Though the same young blade held with his former view that another than her conjugal had been the man in the gap, a clerk in orders, a link boy, virtuous, or an itinerant vendor of articles needed in every household. Singular, communed the guest with himself, the wonderfully unequal faculty of metempsychosis possessed by them, that the pupil dormitory and the dissecting theatre should be the seminaries of such frivolity, that the mere acquisition of academic titles should suffice to transform, in a pinch of time, these votaries of levity into exemplary practitioners of an art which most men anywise eminent have esteemed the noblest. But, he further added, it is mayhap to relieve the pent-up feelings that in common oppress them, for I have more than once observed that birds of a feather laugh together.
So, another Irish writer. Accordingly, he broke his mind in expression of the talk to his neighbour, saying that to express his notion of the thing, his opinion, who, or not perchance, to express one, was that one must have a cold constitution and a frigid genius not to be rejoiced by this freshest news of the fruition of her confinement. So Broom obviously passes on his contentment to whoever is next to him, in all seriousness, of course, since she had been in such pain through no fault of hers. The dressy young blade said it was her husband that had put her in that expectation, or at least it ought to be, unless she were another Ephesian matron. I think that's one who married eventually again, or was in constant need of men. I must acquaint you, said Mr. Crothers, clapping on the table so as to evoke a resonant comment of emphasis, Old Glory Alleluiarum. Now we know Purefoy, Joyce knows him obviously, is a Methodist of some age. They already have a lot of children, and they call him Glory Alleluiarum, making fun of an old man. Was round again today. He came to visit in the afternoon, an elderly man with Dundreary's, whiskers of some sort, preferring through his nose a request to have word of Wilhelmina. So the wife is called Wilhelmina, and of course Methodists would be a kind of more Protestant, and of course they would have words like Wilhelmina with English leanings and not Irish names. So he's, as you say, not the Catholic. Catholic had many children too, but I think Wilhelmina, my life, as he calls her. I bet he holds himself in readiness for that event would burst and all. Life, I'll be round with you. I cannot but extol the virile potency of the old bucko. So again, making fun of a father that is relatively old, that could still knock another child out of her. All fell to praising of it. Probably a kind of mockery. Each after his own fashion, though the same young blade held with his former view that another than her conjugal had been the man in the gap. The clack and all and a link boy, which was it. But it did render of article need in every household. There were always jokes in the old time of hawkers who knocked on the door of housewife having affairs with them. That was a kind of standard chilly joke. Conjugal is a strange word. The word is conjugal. The man you're linked or joined to, yoked to, is your spouse. And here it's conjugal with an I. And that comes from the library chapter where Stephen had used this word with a little I. It's a Swedenborg word, a philosopher, the early 18th century, who had claimed this is conjugal in a spiritual way. Matrimonial relations that were without sexuality. So that's why conjugal is there. Only Swedenborg used it. Singular, communed the guest with himself, the wonderfully unequal faculty of metempsychosis. Here he brings up the word that Molly asked him to. What is metempsychosis when the soul is moved, changed into another body? And here, of course, it's change. Possessed by them, that puerperal dormitory, that is in the hospital, and the dissecting theatre, also, should be the seminaries of such frivolity. They can be so without respect and full of jokes. That the mere acquisition of academic titles, once they pass the exams and acquire a title, a doctor of medicine, should suffice to transform in a pinch of time these votaries of levity into exemplary practitioners of an art. So Broom thinks they're still making jokes and things like that, but once they become doctors, they're a different person with more respect. An art which most men, anyways eminent, have esteemed the noblest, medical. But he further added, it is may help to relieve the pent-up feelings that in common oppress them. I've also heard, I cannot vouch for that at all, that medical students, because they see all kinds of unpleasant things, are more given to jokes than others. No. The pent-up feelings that in common oppress them, for I have more than once observed that birds of a feather laugh together. Now the proverb is birds of a feather flock together. They come together, and here, of course, the medical students, they laugh together. And now the next thing is in the manner of Junius. Now Junius was an unknown, we don't know his name, it's a pseudonym, somebody who attacked very ironically the government. So it's somebody attacked. And this is now addressed, is now in a way addresses Broom. Who is he to say all that?
But with what fitness, let it be asked of the noble lord, his patron, has this alien, whom the concession of a gracious prince has admitted to civil rights, constituted himself the lord paramount of our internal polity? Where is now that gratitude which loyalty should have counseled? During the recent war, whenever the enemy had a temporary advantage with his Granados, did this traitor to his kind not seize that moment to discharge his piece against the empire of which he is a tenant at will, while he trembled for the security of his 4%? Has he forgotten this as he forgets all benefits received? Or is it that from being a deluder of others, he has become at last his own dupe, as he is, if report belie him not, his own and his only enjoyer? Far be it from candor to violate the bedchamber of a respectable lady, the daughter of a gallant major, or to cast the most distant reflections upon her virtue. But if he challenges attention there, as it was indeed highly his interest not to have done, then be it so. Unhappy woman, she has been too long and too persistently denied her legitimate prerogative to listen to his objurgations with any other feeling than the derision of the desperate. He says this, a censor of morals, a very pelican in his piety, who did not scruple, oblivious of the ties of nature, to attempt illicit intercourse with a female domestic drawn from the lower strata of society. Nay, had the hussy scouring brush not been a tutelary angel, it had gone with her as hard as with Hagar the Egyptian. In the question of the grazing lands, his peevish asperity is notorious, and in Mr. Cuff's hearing, brought upon him from an indignant rancher a scathing retort couched in terms as straightforward as they were bucolic. It ill becomes him to preach that gospel. Has he not nearer home a seed field that lies fallow for the want of a plowshare? A habit reprehensible at puberty is second nature and an opprobrium in middle life. If he must dispense his balm of Gilead in nostrums and apothegms of dubious taste to restore to health the generation of unfledged profligates, let his practice consist better with the doctrines that now engross him. His marital breast is the repository of secrets which decorum is reluctant to adduce. The lewd suggestions of some faded beauty may console him for a consort neglected and debauched, but this new exponent of morals and healer of ills is at his best an exotic tree, which, when rooted in its native orient, throve and flourished, and was abundant in balm, but transplanted to a clime more temperate, its roots have lost their quondam vigor, while the stuff that comes away from it is stagnant, acid, and inoperative.
So it's somebody who judges Bloom. Who is he to say this? But with what fitness, let me ask, of the noble lord, his patron, the junior seductor, the government, has this alien, and Bloom is in many an alien, whom the concession of a gracious prince has admitted to civil rights, in other words, who has become a British citizen, was accepted, constituted himself the lord paramount of our internal policy. This is political. Where is now that gratitude which loyalty should have counseled? Basically, he should be quiet and happy that he is accepted. During the recent war, the Boer War, a few years ago, whenever the enemy had a temporary advantage with his grenades, did this traitor to his kind not seize that moment to discharge his piece against the empire, of which he's a tenant at will? That, of course, relies to the Boer War, where the Boer South Africans, Dutch origin, fought the British, and the Dutch first won the first battles. And, of course, the Irish were of two minds. On the one hand, they sided with any enemy of the British Empire, but at the same time, many Irishmen were soldiers in the employ of the British, and they made a living out of it. So that was a kind of ambivalent thing. But Bloom obviously sympathized more with the Boers. To discharge his peace against the empire, of which he's a tenant at will, while he trembled for the securities 4%, and he was worried about his investments and his bank account. Has he forgotten this? Has he forgot all benefits received? Or is it that from being a luder of others, he has become at last his own dupe, as he is? If report belie him not, his own and his only enjoyer, that of course refers to his masturbation. So this would be an author who knows that. Far be it from candor to violate the bedchamber of a respectable lady, the daughter of a gallant major, or to cast the most distant reflections upon her virtue. But if he challenges it, attention there, as it was highly in his interest not to have done, then be it so. In other words, he hasn't, you might say, taken sexual care of his wife. Unhappy woman, she has been too long and too persistently denied the legitimate prerogatives to listen to his objurgation. We don't really know what kind of activity happened between Bloom and Molly in recent years. Obviously not very much. But this is probably one reason why she has her affair on this particular day. with any other feeling than the derision of the despot. He says this, a censor of morals, a very pelican in his piety. Pelicans were supposed to be piety because it was thought they may have red spot on their breast, that they use their own blood to feed the children. So the pelican has a kind of fake reputation for piety, who did not scruple. And now we hear something that we haven't heard of before, who did not scruple, obviously oblivious of his ties of nature, to attempt illicit intercourse with a female domestic drawn from the lowest strata of society. So they must have the female and a servant, and Bloom must have tried to do something. We don't quite know what and how far he would have gone. Nay, had the hussy scouring brush, she happened to have a brush, not been her tutelary angel, the protective angel, it had gone with her, so she escaped it because she fought for herself, had gone as hard as with Hagar, the Egyptian. Hagar, I think that, who was it? I have to find out. Hagar, Hagar, a domestic servant for Abraham. So, obviously, was allowed to do something. Where is it? Hagar was on the Egyptian. And then there's something else about Bloom, which we heard about a little bit before in the question of the grazing lands. He was once a cattle trader, you remember this? His peevish asperity, obviously his impolite favor, is notorious. And in Mr. Cuff, that was an employer at the cattle market, hearing, brought upon him from an indignant rancher a scathing retort couched in terms as straightforward as they were bucolic. We heard something like that in Sirens, and what must have happened, Bloom was employed in the cattle yard, and what probably happened is that the customer was a bit rough with an animal, a horse or a cow, and Broom took up the cause of the cow, the suffering animal, and was sacked. Of course, you can't be impolite to your. So he lost that job because he took the animal's part. It ill becomes him to preach that gospel. The whole thing could, of course, also be a transformation of Bloom saying, but then, who am I to judge others? I have done enough bad things, or not so great things. And it could be a translation of that. Has he not nearer home a seed field that lies fallow for want of a ploughshare? And here you have the old metaphors of ploughing as a metaphor for sexual intercourse. Want of ploughshare. A habit reprehensible at puberty is second nature and appropriate in midlife. Yeah, he also has masturbated, which would have been a sin. If you must dispense a balm of grilled nostrums and aquifer, these are homely medicines, of dubious taste to restore to health the general unfledged profligates, let his practice consist better with a doctrine that now engross him. His marital breast is the repository of secrets, which decorum is reluctant to adduce. He would know more about whatever they did. Now, of course, the lewd suggestions from some faded beauty, some fair, may console him for a concert neglected and debauched. But this new exposure of Lawrence and Hazelfield is at its best an exotic tree. And here's one is different from the other. He has been transplanted from another cultural tree, which, when rooted in its native Orient, throve and flourished, it was abundant in balm, but transplanted to a clime more temperate, that is, when the Jewish father came to Dublin originally, and converted, its root have lost their quondam vigor, their erstwhile vigor, while the stuff that comes away from the stagnant acid and inoperative. He says, but then he's from somewhere else, he's originally from Hungary, and of Jewish origin, he is different and all of that. So this is a kind of Broom's conscience, or somebody expresses this. Now, I don't know whether we probably won't get through the next, but we read a bit. Yeah.
The news was imparted with a circumspection recalling the ceremonial usages of the Sublime Porte by the second female infirmarian to the junior medical officer in residence, who in his turn announced to the delegation that an heir had been born. When he had betaken himself to the women's apartments to assist at the prescribed ceremony of the afterbirth in the presence of the Secretary of State for Domestic Affairs and the members of the Privy Council, silent in unanimous exhaustion and approbation, the delegates, chafing under the length and solemnity of their vigil, and hoping that the joyful occurrence would palliate a license which the simultaneous absence of Abigail and officer rendered the easier, broke out at once into a strife of tongues. In vain, the voice of Mr. Canvas of Bloom was heard endeavouring to urge, to mollify, to restrain. The moment was too propitious for the display of that discursiveness which seemed the only bond of union among tempers so divergent. Every phase of the situation was successfully eviscerated. The prenatal repugnance of uterine brothers, the caesarean section, posthumity with respect to the father, and that rarer form with respect to the mother. The fratricidal case known as the child's murder, and rendered memorable by the impassioned plea of Mr. Advocate Bush, which secured the acquittal of the wrongfully accused. The rights of primogeniture and king's bounty touching twins and triplets, miscarriages and infanticides, simulated and dissimulated, a cardiac fetus in fetu, a prosopia due to a congestion, the ignatia of certain chinless Chinamen, cited by Mr. Cantabate Mulligan, in consequence of defective reunion of the maxillary knobs along the medial line, so that, as he said, one ear could hear what the other spoke, the benefits of anesthesia or twilight sleep, the prolongation of labor pains in advanced gravidancy by reason of pressure on the vein, the premature relentment of the amniotic fluid, as exemplified in the actual case, with consequent peril of sepsis to the matrix, artificial insemination by means of syringes, involution of the womb consequent upon the menopause, the problem of the perpetuation of the species in the case of females impregnated by delinquent rape, that distressing manner of delivery called by the Brandenburgers Sturzgeburt, the recorded instances of multigeminal, twi-kindled, and monstrous births conceived during the catamenic period, or of consanguineous parents. In a word, all the cases of human nativity, which Aristotle has classified in his masterpiece with chromolithographic illustrations.
Yeah, we won't finish that, not today. This is in the manner of Gibbon, the historian of the Roman Empire, the rise and fall of the Roman Empire, who was quite a skeptic. And here you have a different setup. The news was imported with a circumspection, recalling the ceremonial of the Sublime Porte. That was the Ottoman court and things like that, when of course the birth was of a sultan or whatever was celebrated. Sublime Porte, which is Istanbul, I believe, by the second female infirmarian, that's a doctor, to the junior medical officer in residence, who in turn announced to the delegation that an heir has been born. That would be a foreign ceremony. When he had betaken himself to the woman's apartment to assist at the prescribed ceremony of the afterbirth, maybe that was a custom there, in the presence of the Secretary of State for Demonic Affairs and the members of the Privy Council, silent and demanding exhaustion, appropriation, the delegates, chafing under the length and solemnity of the visit and hoping that the joyful occurrence would palliate the license which the simultaneous absence of Abigail, that would be the nurse, and officer rendered easier, broke out at once in a strife of tongues. So we have suddenly been transported to how it would happen in the Ottoman Empire when an heir is born. So the relatively insignificant birth of a Dublin child is transposed into the kind of stuff that Gibbon would have written about. By the way, a strife of tongues is a reference to Babylon, when they built the big tower, God confused their languages and they couldn't understand each other. The strife of tongues. In some way, this chapter, especially at the end, is also a strife of tongues. In vain, the voice of Mr. Canvas Bloom. The various people have different appellation. Mr. Canvas Bloom is a canvas advertisement, was heard endeavoring to urge, to mollify, to restrain. The moment was too propitious for the display of that discursiveness which seemed the only bond of union among tempers so divergent. And now we have a long catalogue of medical things here. Don't worry, because I think it's all one list and we won't get entirely through it. And I may have told you that a medical doctor who came to our readings here had a chair in Düsseldorf, and at one semester he made his students read this particular chapter. And you can see in what you hear, you would need medical experience to tell us what these things are. And so every phase of the situation was successfully eviscerated. That means, of course, talked about, but eviscerated something with the body. the prenatal repugnance of uterine brothers. Uterine brothers are twins in the uterus, and they're often repugnant. Those of us who look into Finnegan's Wake may remember that Sem and Sean are twins, but always in opposition. And of course, the prime example is Cain and Abel, who already fought each other, wrestled in the womb. So uterine brother. Then the cesarean section, we know what that is, which was at that time, I think, relatively rare. Posthumity, with respect to the father, when the father is dead at the moment of birth, the child is born posthumous. And that rare form of respect to the mother. The mother could also die in childbirth, and then you would have this. And we've heard already that they discussed what should happen in this case. The fratricidal case known as the child's murder, when you have child's murder, that was a fratricide, a case that we've been talked about. We've been talking about in Hades. They went past the house where one brother child was murdered and his other brother was accused, but they were acquitted, it couldn't be proved. And of course, child's, there's a name, child's murder can also run of child murder, infanticide. Rendered in memory of the impassioned plea of Mr. Advocate Bush, which secured the acquittal of the wrongfully accused. And at Bush, we've heard of Seymour Bush, a famous lawyer who defended the brother there, and secured the acquittal of the wrongfully accused. Wrongfully accused is what, in Hades, Cunningham says, when they talk about the murder case, that it's better to acquit, it's better for somebody to be acquitted than the other way around. So that's also an echo. The rights of primogeniture, you know that in, especially in the Old Testament, primogeniture was important. The firstborn gets the heritage alone, always. And you remember in the Old Testament how they fought and killed and cheated in order to get the right of the firstborn. And the king's bounty, touching twins and triplets, king's bounty is a sum of money given by the king to twins and triplets. Then you get miscarriages and infanticides. That was quite a problem because many women were just too poor, or they were afraid of the shame of being unmarried mothers. Simulated and dissimulated. Then there's a cardiac, fetus in situ, when one fetus is in another, and there's obviously no heart. Then aprosopia, that is when you have a receding chin, as some have, due to congestion. Then the agnathia, when you have a receding chin of certain chinless Chinamen, Cypercalid Mulligan. They talked about the chinless Chinaman, that is Eglinton. In contrast, the respective reunion of the maxillary knobs along the medial line, so something like that. So, as he said, one ear could hear what the other spoke. The benefits of anesthesia or twilight sleep, and that we heard Bloom about that, that was prolonged very long because the church was dead against anesthesia or painless birth because the curse of Eve, you must bear under pain. And so it took a long time until women were allowed, especially in Catholic religions, to have their pains softened or the prolongation of labor pains in advance by reason of pressure. Sometimes you can prolong the labor pains for some medical reasons. The premature relentment of the amniotic fluid, but as exemplary in the actual case that she had been, with conjugal parosepsis to the matrix. Then you already have artificial insemination by means of syringes. Involution of the womb consequent of the menopause, something that would happen. And and so on. I think I stop here, and we have to resume in the middle. And you see, it at times it gets very technical, and we know that Joyce studied medical books in order to. And we also know that Joyce and Nora in Trieste had a misbirth. They had two children, but there was also a misbirth, things like that. So we come back to this fairly long paragraph then. Yeah, maybe jumping over it again. Yeah, so we come forward in time and things are sometimes a little bit easier. Next time we also come to my favorite passage, the next one, and so on through the ages, getting closer to the 19th century. Okay, I hope you come along. It's a chapter of hard labor. See you in a week then.
Thank you very much. Bye bye.
Thanks, Fritz. Bye.
Bye.